name's Shahan.
Shahan, thanks for talking to the Cambridge Service Alliance podcast series today about your new paper, Service in the Platform Context, a Review of the State of Art. How did you go about your study and why? It's certainly very topical.
It is indeed, and that's exactly why we have started this research. The concept of platform has sparked the interest of both industries and academics alike. So I think a very appropriate quote from TechCrunch 2015 is that Uber, the world's largest taxi company, doesn't own any taxi, and Airbnb, the world's largest accommodation provider, doesn't own any assets. Facebook, the world's largest content provider, doesn't create any content. So this is a very interesting phenomenon which requires further research. And after our studies, we have identified about 110 articles. However, very few of them go into depth to analyze the situation. So I hope to contribute my research.
And you mentioned Uber, Airbnb, and Facebook. Now, they're platform companies. Can you tell me about how you define a platform? Is it easy to define a platform? Do we all know what a platform is?
That's a very good question. Actually, it's still being debated in the literature, but generally, it has a converging view. Platform generally has two characteristics. The first one is an architectural one. So a platform is basically a core problem-solving component that's been shared by multiple parties. And the second characteristic of a platform is an economic one. So the number of participants in a platform directly affects the value being created by the platform. This is known as the network effect. I'll give a very extreme example. So in the case of a telephone, it has zero value if it's just there alone. But if you have a multiple telephones in a network, the value increases exponentially.
And so does a platform reach a point when it becomes a platform, when it has 100 or 1,000 people using it? Is there a critical point at which you can say this is a platform?
The platform can be in various scales. There are smaller platforms who are successful. There are also large platforms who are not successful. So it's all a matter of perspective. But I think the key takeaway is that the platform is able to leverage the network externality coming out of their participants.
What are the key issues the literature focuses on and why?
The literature has generally three streams of research. The first one deals with platform adoption. Why would companies adopt to a platform? And the second one is the platform's impact on the industry. For example, the creation of Craigslist, what's its impact on the newspapers? And the most prominent literature in the research is platform leadership, how a platform can become a leader.
How can a platform become a leader? That is a key question.
Indeed, it's a billion-dollar question. The literature has identified a lot of ways to leverage that. I will just give you a few examples. So one of the most prominent ways to become a platform leader is through what they call a coring process. Basically, make your technology or your platform extremely sophisticated so other people cannot easily copy that. So this is best illustrated by Intel and its microprocessors. The other one is how to leverage the network and what they call tipping strategy, how to leverage the network of participants to actively engage and benefit from the network. Those are mostly the research directions.
So you have to have a good designer, what they call a good architecture for your platform, so it can't be copied. And then you have to get the right people to join your network. But that presumes that you've done a lot of research as to what your users want and who your users are.
Indeed. And it's not just traditional thinking. Research and development and then deployment actually is continuously tuning your platform to achieve the most appropriate level of network externality.
Were the platforms that started different from the ones we've got now? If we look at Facebook, which is perhaps one of the more successful older platforms, and now WhatsApp, which reaches millions of people but employs very few relatively.
Indeed, and Facebook benefited a lot from the install base because they were one of the first most successful platforms who got a lot of investment, and they're able to spend that investment into researching into future directions. Whereas, as you mentioned, WhatsApp, it's a relatively new company and their functions are still limited and they're still trying to explore the ways to generate revenue. It's not necessarily the new ones are cheaper than the old one. It's just that they're at different stages of development. development.
And you say the telephone was a platform?
Indeed, it was. It was one of the earlier platforms. And what they have is direct network effect. They have only one side of the people. So you use a telephone, I use a telephone. That's our value exchange. But gradually in the 80s, there were all these game consoles who also benefit not only the users, but the game developers. So it's a continuous progress into today. And what's distinguished today from before is the technology competencies these companies have and how quickly they can deploy a platform. Just over the course of past 2-3 years, I've seen many new players that we didn't even hear before, and they've become extraordinarily large. Uber, it's one of the best examples of such new platforms. So what they tapped in is the capability to leverage other people's abundant resource. So if I have a car, I'm not using it, so the asset is there. What I can do is just to spend part of my time in exchange for money. That was previously unachievable with the accessibility of smartphones to almost everybody.
If we look at the research now, was there a lot of research to draw on? You talked about looking at 110 articles. Were they recent articles, or was some of them older?
Well, most of them are extremely new. The discussion really started around 2006. We see more than 5 papers published per year. And then it really started to increase exponentially around 2008, 2009. And that coincides with the new age of the platform, so to speak.
What kind of access did the peer-reviewed articles have to actual case studies within industry? Or were they all conceptual? Were these papers based on people going into industries, platform industries, and studying them?
It's a increasing trend. Initially, they were mostly conceptual, but now we see that out of the 110 papers, actually more than 70 of them were empirically based. Some of them are single cases, some of them are employing like surveys and multiple case studies. So it's a field being further explored. However, it has not reached the maturity of many other literature that we're studying at the moment.
Are we right to call platforms and platform technology a disruptive technology? How different is this form of innovation from previous industrial changes or even revolutions? Is it very new?
I think platform business models, a lot of them are based on the disruptive technologies, as we said, internet, for example, and the accessibility of smartphones. So that's just one aspect of how they can leverage that. So that's just the support. But as a business model, I think it's more of a paradigm shift of how you view your company. So platform, rather than traditional companies making and producing products and selling to customers, they are actually matching the needs of suppliers and customers. So that's, I think, the key changes in the industry.
And are platforms mainly a consumer concept? Are they ever applied to manufacturing? So you can get your networks of people, you can tell them about things, they can have discussions, because unlike the telephone, there's more than one person joining in, whether you're on Facebook or email and the internet or even WhatsApp, you can have a user group. But is it really a force for productivity? What comes out of a platform?
From the manufacturing concept, there are actually studies called modular design. So you have a traditional sense of a platform, a physical platform, and different suppliers assemble their products based on the model that you have described to them. However, the key difference between this type of manufacturing platform and what we talk about today's platforms, such as Facebook or Uber, is that the network externality of those manufacturing platforms are very limited. And there are attempts to increase the effect of such platforms. However, there are more research need to be done.
Platforms can in the future become more oriented towards productive business model and productive industries. But at the moment, they're service platforms.
Indeed, service platforms are probably benefiting a lot more than the traditional manufacturing platforms. Meanwhile, they're facing a lot more challenges than the traditional platform. So for instance, Facebook, even though it's a very advanced, very large platform, functionally speaking, it's not very difficult for you and me to sit down and write a program about it. So their challenge is how to create values for their customers to maintain them in their platform. And as you have seen, Mark Zuckerberg have been trying all sorts of things to make Facebook relevant in the future. So it's a very fast-moving and very challenging sphere.
Because the thing about platforms is they may have millions of users. They're not necessarily profitable for their shareholders.
A lot of the platforms, they actually are technology-driven. So the examples we have, so they come up with a good technology, they develop it without thinking about the business model further on. However, some of the platforms actually have made very good progress in terms of generating revenues, both for themselves and for the content providers and customers. So I think at the moment, YouTube is making a good example. They share their ad revenue model with the content providers, hence giving them more incentive to produce quality content, and for customers, obviously, to stay further on YouTube.
And then if we look at that million-dollar question you referred to earlier, did you look at what makes a company a platform leader, or are you leaving that to further research?
Well, actually, it's a never-ending research. And obviously, the simple answer is that the most number of customers and suppliers you have, you're obviously a leader. But the more difficult question is how you can maintain that position, how you can transform your platform to be relevant in the future. And I think three areas are most crucial. Number one is that your platform needs to solve a real-life problem. And number two is that you need to balance the relationship between you and your party. And number three is to govern your ecosystem to make the platform sustainable for the future.
And are platforms ecosystems that have come together to solve problems? Do they come out of a collective mindset rather than an individual sitting in a room having a eureka moment?
They come in both forms. So some of them are just creative minds, two or three people sitting in a garage and inventing something completely new. So the best example is Google, just a couple of guys from Stanford and then doing their PhD and then realize...
playing on their parents' computers.
Exactly. And then realize there's a huge potential of search engine in the future. Whereas there are also collective needs of multiple parties in the ecosystem. And some of the people actually sit down and then decided, actually, this is the process to move forward. So basically, by aligning the suppliers of different fields and the customers, they can create a platform that's feasible for them. So in the case of Alibaba, that's the best case. Jack Ma saw something in the United States that's potentially very interesting. So he tried to convince all sorts of suppliers to participate in his platform, though through almost a decade of suffering, he finally succeeded. And then now he's the richest man in China. So that's another extreme example of a platform.
And Tencent too in China. But adoption, if you've got an idea, whether you're a group of people, whether you're working formally in labs or just in a garage, you have a great idea. What about adoption? How do you get people to take up that great idea? For instance, Uber, there were safety issues, there were legal issues, there were payment issues. They've faced courts and actions in countries like India, but it has taken off.
Indeed, and adoption will be the research focus of my next paper, which I hope to discuss further with you. But in general, indeed, adoption is obviously the key to success of platforms, and not only to the customers, but also providers. So in terms of customers, the case that we had just talked about, Uber, it gives the customers seamless service experience. So that was previously unheard. So there's no hassle, no paying tips. Everything is done smoothly. So that's the value the customers perceive. And also the other side, there should be real problem solving for the providers. So if I own a car, I have excessive assets. So why don't I make a few bucks out of it in a safe, secure way? So by balancing the supply and demand, Uber has succeeded in providing valuable services to their customers, both sides.
And you also seem to refer, Sai, in your paper to the unknown unknowns. So we've got the economic potential, the technology, and you refer to something called the bandwagon. Are there things we still don't know and that we need to research more?
Indeed. Why would you participate, especially in the social media side of platforms, right? Why is Twitter more attractive than Facebook, or why is Facebook more attractive than MySpace? So these are a continuous evolution of making yourself relevant that the platform leaders need to continuously ask themselves. What's the value proposition? What do customers want? And what do your content or suppliers want? So that's all a very difficult question.
Is it helpful to pull all this research together, 110 papers, you're having to look at databases too, and it's only since 2008, really, the literature has got off the ground, so it's all very new, relatively. But what did you find the most surprising when you looked at all of this? Was there a revelation in it for you?
Well, actually, there were a lot of revelations for me. First of all, for me personally, how much research has gone into this and how wide a spectrum they have looked at, whereas there are also areas they have failed to look at, just as you ask the adoption question. Well, there are obviously problems with adoption, but very few people have looked any further than the immediate economic factors of adoption. And there are also the question of social implications. Why are platforms significant? So there are a lot of challenges to be filled in the literature, but obviously we need a lot more in-depth research to answer these questions.
And if we can't answer that $100 question of what makes a platform successful, might it be just that you need a lot of confidence and blind faith?
That's what most people do. And in Silicon Valley, everybody says that I'm proposing the next platform of the generation and so on and so forth. Actually, majority of them fail because they failed to first solve a real life problem and two, to generate the network externality needed for a platform to succeed.
Sayhan, thanks for talking to the Cambridge Service Alliance podcast series today about your new paper, Service in the Platform Context, a review of the state of the art. I've learned so much.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.